see that the same race made them, but this one, Edmus said, highlighting the saw probe, appears to be more sophisticated, a later version.
Precisely, sir, Esteban said, with a touch of pride in his business partner.
Now observe again. The display changed to view the Sol probe, which nestled in a small field of asteroids.
I will accelerate the event which took place during the course of 2 days, Esteban explained.
Did that probe steer away from that rock? Jodlin asked when the sequence ended.
That would be the only possible explanation, sir, Esteban replied.
Black space, Edmus commented, which earned him a nudge in the ribs from Jodlin.
Patrice smiled. It had been many years since she'd heard that expression.
I take it something is wrong, she said.
We have several problems, Oluwole replied. We want to catch the probe in as uncongested an area as possible. No mining sites and few rocks, which could be ejected like missiles from the blast. Now we have a probe that can play hide-and-seek. For all we know, it's more maneuverable than our tool, the Banisher.
That rules out one of our destroyer's missiles, Patrice added.
Are you sure the probe will detonate? Nikki asked.
The Meridians used a salvo of rocks that eventually broke the probes into pieces without detonating them, Francis explained.
But every probe that has been captured by a Banisher or investigated has detonated.
At the mention of the Meridians, Patrice and Nikki glanced at Esteban, who appeared to be undisturbed by the mention of his former masters.
"What's the plan, then?" Patrice asked.
When the Omnian's glances bounced from one to the other, she moaned,
"Oh, great! The more technologically sophisticated and advanced civilization doesn't have an answer for removing our alien probe without creating potential collateral damage."
"Not yet, sir," Esteban replied.
"But as a human, you should never give up hope."
Then he smiled congenially at Patrice, who smacked his shoulder. She shook off the sting while the others laughed at Esteban's twist on Oluwole's comment.
"What about what the Harrican carriers did at Idona?" Nikki asked, staring at the holovid display. "Can this ship do that?"
Esteban raced through the controller's historical data on the carrier's defense of the station and reviewed Alex's technique that his people and Sades implemented. He spooled images onto the holovid of one of the carriers racing forward and twisting to release a load of tethered asteroids.
"We have that capability," Francis said. "We'd have to clear the bays of travelers and banishers, but we could grasp 2 good-sized rocks. Esteban would be capable of executing the maneuver."
"But would the technique work against this probe?" Edmus asked.
"Maybe not on the first go," Jodlin said. "But what if we set up a chase pattern?"
The Earthers were left out of the conversation, which took place among Esteban, Edmus, Jodlin, and Francis, but they were able to follow the scenario which was displayed on the holovid. Esteban placed a timeline along the probe's route as the team formed their plan. The Reaver would shoot ahead of the probe and pull out a collection of dense asteroids, piling them up at the proposed attack point. Then Esteban would set the timing release of each set of rocks by the passenger liner.
"Won't the probe move out of the way of what you're throwing? You can only load 2 rocks and throw 1 at a time, Nikki asked.
"That's the concept of a chase attack," Jodlin explained. "You don't expect results from the first step. You anticipate success by the final action, or you repeat the process until you get the results you want," Jodlin explained.
When Nikki frowned, Esteban elaborated.
"We expect the probe to evade, but it will probably do so by backing away and using other asteroids to hide behind, always moving farther out in the belt. If fortune holds, we might strike an asteroid near it to damage the probe, preventing it from maneuvering."
"And if not?" Patrice asked.
"You continue launching rocks until you can break it into pieces or it self-destructs with minimal collateral impact," Jodlin said.
One way or the other, we will continue to pressure the probe, Francis summarized. We might even chase it beyond the belt. If we do, we can launch the Banisher at it. Our tool will be able to attain a tremendous velocity before contact, and the probe will not have anywhere to hide or time to evade. Patrice updated Commodore Binghamton on the new plan, while Francis accelerated the Reaver toward the first point Esteban had indicated. Meanwhile, the SAID was examining asteroids to choose similar types and sizes that the action required. This time, the rock launching process would be much more difficult. The Harrigans had the support of the belt miners, who harvested, prepped, and positioned the asteroids for the carriers. It took several days before the plan was ready. The travelers and banishers waited beside the stockpile of asteroid missiles. A rock was held firmly in the grip of each bay's tethering beams. Esteban's colonel was fully engaged with the ship's controller. He'd automated every sequence he could so that he only had to cue the next action. When the countdown ended, Esteban signaled the controller, which launched the ship forward, and soon after, it swung to port to release one rock and swiveled to starboard to release the other. Esteban's triggering of a reload sequence had the controller reversing the ship's course, so the crews could latch on to two more asteroids. Esteban, the liner, and the crew busied themselves during the next hours, launching wave after wave of rocks at the probe. When their pile of rocks was exhausted, Esteban signaled the end of the exercise to everyone. Jerry calmed the other pilots to return to the ship, and Esteban recovered the two banishers after the travelers landed aboard.
"Now we wait?" Nicky asked.
"Now we wait," Esteban agreed.
"Why don't we use the time to gather another pile of rocks?" Patrice asked.
"An experiment requires you to observe the reactions to your actions," Jodlin replied.
"Meaning you think this might not work?" Patrice pressed.
When Jodlin shrugged her shoulders, Patrice remarked,
"Seems to me I've seen that response before. I didn't think much of it then, either."
Jodlin smiled pleasantly at Patrice, who couldn't have known what Oluwale had sent to his fellow Omnians, which was, "This is their system, and they're frightened by what we've said and shown them. Be patient with them."
"It's time," Esteban sent.
By the ship's clock, it was the middle of the night, and the Omnians hurried from their beds. When the signal to the Earther women's readers failed to wake them, Esteban knocked politely at their cabin door, but that also failed to get a response. The SAID signaled the cabin door's release and silently crossed the small salon to the sleeping quarters. He knocked firmly and finally got an answer, notifying the women that they were needed on the bridge. "Shades of the Military Academy," Patrice groused, bleary-eyed and barely awake when she gained the bridge. Soon Nicky and Patrice were brought calf by a server who Patrice wanted to gratefully kiss. Francis had the holovid active and trained on the probe. The angle was wide enough to see the last moments of the rush of each rock at the Nual device. "Slippery little thing, isn't it?" Patrice noted after the probe slid aside from the initial onslaught of asteroids.
"More advanced software than we've seen previously," Esteban commented.
As time dragged on, individuals sat on the deck to watch, while Oluwale and Francis enjoyed the comfort of the command chairs. Naturally, Esteban had locked his avatar and was analyzing the trajectory of each rock, local impacts, and the probe's reaction. With only six more rocks to go, the probe moved behind an asteroid, which the liner's next rock struck, causing the displacement of the probe by the asteroid it hid behind. The fifth-to-last rock missed the probe, but it was in the open. That necessitated the probe dodge both numbers 4 and 3 of the countdown. Then, without warning, vidcams were blinded by a massive explosion, the blast destroying and launching belt debris in all directions.
"Captain," Esteban said with urgency,
"Jerry, launch all ships. You have some clean-up work to do. "Crew chiefs, ready the launch of all travelers," Francis sent.
"What just happened?" Patrice asked, on her feet and staring at the hollow vid, which had regained the image of the belt. There was an enormous cleared area.
"We are launching our fighters to destroy the rocks which have been thrown inward," Francis explained.
"Understood, Captain. My question was meant to ask for an explanation about what happened to the probe. Besides exploding, I mean."
"We didn't hit it," Patrice riposted.
"Good question," Oluwole said, glancing toward Esteban.
"Different probe, newer version, better programming," Edmus replied instead, enumerating the different factors they faced.
"Sayre has the essence of it," Esteban agreed. "I would surmise the probe's detection programs recognized a pattern in the rocks that were approaching. It might have even connected their onslaught to our ship as the instigating party, in which case the application might have concluded that it had been discovered, which led to the detonation."
"The Commodore," Nikki said, holding up her reader to Esteban.
"Captain Degarde here," was heard over the reverse bridge speakers after the Sade placed the call.
"Thus concludes the Omnian demonstration of the dangers of alien probes, Captain," Nikki quipped.
"And an eye-opening demonstration it was, Governor," Commodore Binghamton replied. "Are the odd ships that launched from your liner the Omnian fighters?"
"Travelers, they're called, Commodore," Nikki replied.
"Please tell me you're doing everything possible to procure us the means of having these travelers for ourselves, Governor. It's rumored that the Colonel and you are favorites of Alex Racine."
"Negotiations are ongoing, Commodore," Nikki replied, staring intently at Oluwole. "By the way, you're free to begin your trip to Earth."
"One question for our friends, if they're listening, Governor."
"They are, Commodore. Go ahead."
"Initially, you requested a clearance radius of 16 million kilometers, but then you doubled that. Our instrumentation registered the wave's destructive reach attained 21 million. Why the radius change? Not that I minded being moved beyond what turned out to be the danger zone."
"To paraphrase an Omnian captain, Darius Gamata, who exhibits a healthy respect for the unknown, I chose to apply an extra portion of insurance when I recognized that this probe was quite possibly a newer model," Esteban explained.
"Hmm," the Commodore muttered, dwelling on the explanation. "I think I like this Omnian captain. He's my kind of officer, careful and smart. And my cap is off to you, Esteban, for your successful efforts. Governor, I'll be making my report to the President and putting in a good word for your friends. Binghamton out."
"I estimate the traveler pilots will be busy for 5.6 days, sir," Esteban said, directing his comment at Oluwole.
"We can take our guests to Idona Station and return for our travelers," Francis suggested.
"How about your pilots? Won't they need to rest during the next 6 days?" Nikki asked with concern.
"They'll have it, Governor," Esteban replied. "I'm programming their controllers so that the operations of prioritizing targets, closing on an asteroid, and destroying it are automated. The pilots can sleep and eat whenever they choose."
"Now I know the Commodore would really want some of these," Patrice said, laughing.
"Well, we have a few days' ride to Idona," Nikki said. "However, I'm now wide awake. This seems like the opportune time, Oluwole, to have a quiet chat. Just the three of us, Patrice, you and me."
"I'm at your disposal, Governor," Oluwole said politely, and waved the women toward the bridge accessway.
Settling into the comfortable chairs in Olawale's salon, Nikki opened the discussion.
"Oluwole, you, more than anyone else, know what the people of Sol have been through. The interminably long decades of deprivation and incarceration under United Earth nearly brought us to the brink of ruin. But we've changed, thanks to Alex Racine and his people, and there's no going back for us."
"Is your government still called United Earth?" Oluwole asked.
"No," Nikki replied firmly. "When the new constitution was ratified by the elected representatives and governors, it was done so under the banner of Sol Enclave."
But, and you'll appreciate this, Oluwole, people refer to the Constitution as the Idona Accord, Patrice said, grinning. Oluwole, we can't thank you enough for remembering your homeworld and returning to check on us, Nikki said. The stories of the spheres are frightening, but knowing the probes are present across so many systems is absolutely terrifying. What does Alex think? Patrice asked. Her eyes locked onto Oluwole's, demanding a forthright answer.
Alex and Julian believe the probes indicate that an ancient and widespread civilization is seeking ever more space, and has been working at expanding its territory far longer than humans have been traveling to the stars.
Nikki and Patrice regarded each other. Words weren't necessary. They'd already discussed what they intended to ask Oluwole. Now, what they'd thought might be a request had been suddenly transformed into an appeal.
"We need your help, Oluwole," Nikki said. "Or, more precisely, we need the Omnian's help. Sol is getting back on its feet, but it will take us a while before we reach the stage where we could protect ourselves from a sphere."
"Yes, we have heavy warships with firepower," Patrice added. "But they haven't the capability to intercept a sphere, and they fire missiles. It doesn't sound as if these would be effective against the sphere or its defenses." Oluwole silently shook his head.
"But according to Esteban Edmondson Jodlin, your people have increased their military power specifically to take on these Nual spheres," Nikki said.
The mention of his companions' names in conjunction with the information about Omnia ships, which might better have been kept private, told Oluwole how much his comrades wanted to help the people of Sol, who were valiantly trying to put an ugly past behind them.
"Do you think Alex will be successful against this second sphere?" Patrice asked.
"I'm worried, like most people are, Patrice. But then again, it's Alex," Oluwole said, lifting his hands to indicate that was all he could offer.
Patrice and Nikki nodded thoughtfully. Some animals, such as cats, were reputed to have multiple lives. Both women were considering the possibility that Alex was an amalgam of many cats.
"I can tell you," Oluwole said, "that Alex requested a report on the progress that was being made for the people of Sol by your government. In that regard, I found the conversation with your president refreshing, and the fact that you two hold senior positions is illuminating."
"I knew there was a reason I wore my best dress to our first dinner," Nikki rejoined.
"And it was most becoming," Oluwole replied, a twinkle in his eye.
"I swear there's some of that Omnian advanced technology in you, Oluwole," Nikki replied, laughing. "At times you act like a man half your age."
When Oluwole winked, Patrice groaned.
"That's not fair, Oluwole. We need that medical support as much as you. Can't you share?"
"I'm sorry, it's not possible, but if you'd like to immigrate to Omnia, I'm sure you'd find life exciting."
"Probably more exciting than we can handle," Nikki admitted.
"You never know," Oluwole replied, leaning back in his chair, an expansive air about him.
"Back to business," Nikki said. "Would Omnia be willing to help us?"
Oluwole reviewed his conversation with Alex, who had left it to him as to what he could say.
"I would like this conversation to be shared only with your most senior people," Oluwole replied. "I can tell you that you're not requesting aid from the Omnian government, but from Omnia ships."
"One company?" Patrice asked.
"One man, Alex, who holds the majority of shares. The warships that Omnia Ships has built and are chasing the second sphere have come about because of some incredible technological innovations. How Omnia came into being, including Omnia Ships, is a long story. But the upshot is this. Alex was setting up agreements with his ex-homeworld, Herrikan, another single system, New Terra, and the multi-colony civilization called the Confederation."
"All human?" Patrice asked.
"Yes," Oluwole replied.
When I left Omnia, these governments were considering a contract with Omnia ships that allowed them access to our warship and scout ship technology, which they could construct, in exchange for supplying Alex with half their contingent to fight with the Omnians.
"And Alex thinks he will need that greater force," Patrice said, sitting forward on the edge of her chair.
"Seems so," Oluwale replied.
"Would Alex consider offering Saul the same agreement?" Nikki asked.
"It's not that simple, Nikki. Your technology is far behind that of these other worlds."
"But we're another system of humans, Oluwale," Patrice persisted. "We need protection, and we can help Alex. You know we won't shirk from a fight, alien or not."
"I have no doubt of the courage of you two," Oluwale said, shifting to the edge of his chair.
His big hands were clasped tightly together. He desperately wanted to help the people of his original homeworld, but he couldn't forget the many who had been sacrificed under the crushing boots of United Earth. To give Saul advanced technology only to see the government backslide and use it against the populace would be unacceptable. Worse, it would scar Alex to think he'd done that. Nikki hand-signaled Patrice out of sight of Oluwale. It asked her to wait and give Oluwale time to think.
"I will promise you this," Oluwale said after a few minutes of silence. "My report to Alex will be favorable. That might lead to something, or he might want to visit and see the changes for himself. Either way, don't expect immediate results."
"What if that sphere visits us in the meantime?" Patrice asked.
"Highly unlikely, and you don't have to take my word for that," Oluwale said, raising his hands to fend off Patrice's objections. "It's the consideration of the Sades that this second sphere is investigating systems on the other side of our worlds."
"Meaning it will go through your worlds before us," Patrice surmised.
"That's exactly what I mean," Oluwale replied.
"Enough said," Nikki said, rising. "We'll take you at your word, Oluwale, and we hope to see Alex and you in the near future." The women said good night and left Oluwale to spend several hours considering what he would say to Alex. When the Reaver drew near Idona, Patrice arranged for a small militia shuttle to transfer Nikki and her to the station. After the Idona vessel landed aboard the liner's bay, the Omnians saw their guests off. It was a bittersweet moment, old friends separating again amid a cloud of uncertainty. The last in line for goodbyes was Esteban.
"Thank you, Esteban," Nikki said, hugging the Sade.
"I'm happy that you've been freed, Esteban," Patrice said when she embraced him, delivering a kiss to his cheek. When the shuttle hatch closed behind its passengers, Esteban commented,
"I rather like Earthers."
Oluwale laughed and clapped him on the shoulder.
"You like being hugged and kissed."
"It was a pleasant experience," Esteban replied.
Francis returned to the site of the probe's detonation to collect the travelers, which had completed their destruction of the larger asteroids. The remaining rocks, much smaller in size, would burn up when they entered the atmosphere of any populated planets, or the defense networks would remove them. The Omnians settled in for the trip home, all of them wondering how their fleet was faring.
Chapter 22 Found and Lost. The squadron had transited 7 times following their exit from the worlds of light. Each time the scout ships had searched and managed to pick up the sphere's trail, and the fleet had followed. Telemetry was analyzed to determine the approximate length of time that the system's prime worlds had remained fallow since they were ravaged. The answers supplied by those estimations allowed the Omnians to count down the decades as they closed on the Nual ship. By the Sade's calculation, there was a high probability that the last system entered might have contained the sphere. Now the odds had reached nearly 100% that the Nual vessel would be found in any one of the systems the scout ships were presently searching.
"'We're getting close, Alex,' Tatia said, her voice earnest. "'Very close,' Alex agreed, before turning in for a night's sleep. Unfortunately for Alex, sleep never came. "'My love,' Renee murmured, half awake in the early hours of the morning, "'as much as I want you in our bed, I prefer you either paying attention to me or asleep. "'You've been doing neither.' Go speak with Julian and resolve whatever is troubling you. Renee rolled to her other side, away from Alex, and he slipped out of bed, pinging Julian. "'Can't sleep?' Julian asked. "'I'd like to chat,' Alex replied. "'The Grand Park would be a nice spot if we had one. "'I miss the city ship, too, for more than one reason.' I'm sorry to have separated you from your partner, my friend. There will be time for us, Alex. The difference in lifespans between humans and Sage reared its ugly head, and Alex grunted in reply. The two friends met on the warship's bridge. A second lieutenant offered his command chair, but Alex waved him off. He sat with his back against the rear bulkhead, and Julian sat beside him. The lieutenant never heard a word of Alex and Julian's conversation. The pair communicated entirely via implant and comm. They might have conducted this exchange from their respective places without meeting. It just wasn't the way the two friends preferred to chat. "'What if we're not being clever or cagey enough about this sphere?' Alex asked. "'In what manner, Alex?' Julian sent in reply. Everything we've recently discovered about the Nual indicates that, historically, we've been fortunate. I don't mean about what happened in the Confederation, but since then. At Libra, it appeared to be a single ship that we destroyed. The discovery of a second sphere didn't seem to be that intimidating, but the discovery of a probe in every system that we've investigated has me thinking that we're not prepared to compete at a high enough level. You're considering that we've only begun to discover the extent of the Nual reach and their technological power, Julian commented. Yes, that too, but specifically I'm thinking about this sphere we're chasing. How so, Alex? We have this squadron of tridents, bays full of fighters, and advance scout ships to prevent us from dividing our forces. Yes, everyone's a little nervous about a fight, but there's an attitude in the fleet that the Nual vessel is out of options, especially with only one remaining bullet ship. You believe that we're being overly optimistic, expecting to win the upcoming fight. If it is a straight-up fight, I think we can handle it. But what if it isn't? Explain, Julian requested. Let's say you're in command of this sphere. What are you seeing? Collecting your information day after day, annual after annual. Julian leaned his head against the bulkhead, imitating Alex. It was something that humans and Sades close to the pair noticed about them. They were slowly adopting the habits of each other. The words "the other twins" were often mentioned in close circles when referring to them. I would receive continual input from my probes, Julian sent. They would be communicating information about the systems that I could prosecute, the opportunities on the prime planets, the civilizations present, the shipping in system, and the extent of the defenses. Under the circumstances of carrying a single bullet ship, I would choose the systems less guarded, as I would be on the defensive, which means I would be monitoring my probe broadcast intensely. Julian halted his summary, and his head snapped off the bulkhead as he sent, "'And I would know that I'm losing probe signals in particular areas of the galaxy.' "'Especially in a trail behind you growing ever closer to you,' Alex finished. While the pair sat with their thoughts about what it meant to be hunting an adversary that might know it's being chased, Julian sent, "'We're about to discover how well the enemy is aware of us, Alex. Lynn's scout ship, the Minimum Risk, has reported it's located the sphere.'
Julian directed the squadron toward the new destination, and the fleet controllers dutifully executed their directives. Simultaneously, he notified the five other scout ships of the discovery and the rendezvous coordinates. The energy and attitudes of the fleet's personnel changed, especially aboard the new Terran warships, where the arguments and fights ceased overnight. Boredom was replaced by anticipation. Frustration gave way to focused intention. Tatia reviewed the attack scenarios with her senior officers, depending on the final disposition of their adversary. The minimum risk had reported the sphere was underway within the system. With the scout ship's orders to collect minimal telemetry and withdraw far beyond the system, there was no way the fleet could know whether the sphere was entering or exiting the system. The fleet imitated the minimum risk and transited into a position far outside the target system. They waited for the lengthy time period that telemetry required to update at such a great distance. When the data was received, Tatia eyed Alex and said, "I don't get it. The fourth planet outward should have been the sphere's target planet. It's the optimal body if you want to consider that ice ball a resource. What's the ship doing parked near that gas giant with its hundreds of moons?" Tatia said.
"Waiting for us, I presume," Alex replied.
"And you were going to tell me this when?" Tatia asked, rounding on Alex, irritation in her eyes.
"It was a theory that Julian and I were discussing last night. My question for you, Admiral, is this. Does your plan of attack change depending on where the sphere is stationed?"
"No, but, and does it matter that the sphere might have suspected we were closing in on it, versus seeing us coming for days while we crossed space on our approach?" Alex pressed on.
"No," Tatia admitted.
"That's why I chose not to complicate your tactics with my musings."
"Still, it would have been nice to have been included," Tatia said, unwilling to give ground on the idea that she'd been left out of the loop. Julian wasn't spared either. He received a glower from her. More than 2 weeks later, the last of the scout ships arrived. The six tiny ships were scattered to positions that ringed the system and lay outside the orbit of the outermost planet. The vessels had no offensive capability, but were tasked with determining the sphere's flight vector if it ran for it. Alex and Julian's consensus was that if the sphere chose to evade a fight, then the possibilities were good it would select a course that wouldn't launch it toward another probe. The fleet had depended on the sphere's single-minded pursuit of one probe signal after another. If it abandoned that routine, the Omnians would have little possibility of following it. While the scout ships took up their positions, Reiko set her forces in motion. Eight tridents spread out, six taking up positions around the ecliptic and one trident each approaching the sphere from above and below the ecliptic. Every individual, human and Sade, was glued to the fleet's telemetry feeds. Confusing to all was that while the fleet spread out, the sphere never moved.
"It's waiting and watching," Z said.
"We're showing our cards," Alex added, "and it's making judgments about the size and capability of our forces."
"It can strategize all at once. The fact of the matter is that it has limited options. Run now or run after it sends that single bullet ship out to fight and we destroy it," Tatia said with determination. When the fleet was ready, Tatia looked at Reiko.
"It's your fight, Commodore."
Reiko triggered the Trident's controllers to execute the battle plan. Depending on their positions, the Tridents were launched in a delayed pattern toward their adversary. The farthest away from the sphere started first, and the others followed so that the eight warships would close on the enemy vessel together. The crew's exhilaration gave way to the realities of space travel, even for highly developed technological societies. Officers changed bridge duty shifts. Crews ate, slept, and, when on duty, checked and rechecked their readiness. And still, the sphere didn't move.
Maybe the poor thing ran out of power, Miranda quipped at one point. Or maybe it managed to complete the other three bullet ships it's been building, Z commented. Reiko looked between Z and Miranda, finally staring at Julian. If you're waiting for my comment, Commodore, I have none. I await the outcome of this fight, Julian replied.
Now that's the kind of emotional support I appreciate, Reiko retorted, giving Z and Miranda a less than appreciative glance. There had been a short discussion between Tatia, Reiko, and Svetlana about holding the OS Liberator back, allowing the other seven Tridents to be at the forefront of the attack. However, Alex heard, and he quickly truncated that discussion. "Admiral, you haven't enough Tridents to effectively surround the sphere as it is," Alex said. "Holding this ship back will allow it wider avenues of escape. Worse, if you keep the other seven Tridents in the same dispositions but we stay back, then the sphere might opt to come in our direction, throwing the bullet ship out in front of it to run interference."
"No, Admiral, stick with your original battle plan." Despite the greatly increased strength and effective range of the Trident's beams, the warships were hours away from beginning the attack when the sphere made its move. The greatest avenues of escape were above and below the ecliptic, and the Noal sphere chose below. Admiral Tripping's flagship, the N.T. Jeffrey Orlan, was on the ecliptic. Alphonse Chigelsky's trident, the N.T. Arthur McMorris, was approaching the sphere from above, and the N.T. Lem Ulam, Bart Philister's trident, was in the path of the escaping sphere. The sphere accelerated and twisted in half, as had the Libran sphere, exposing its four large ports, evenly placed around the circumference. Soon afterwards, the sphere's remaining bullet ship exited and sped ahead.
"Don't let that bullet ship get past you, Captain Philister," Tripping ordered. "We can trap the sphere between us if it's defenseless."
"Negative, Admiral Tripping. That's not one of the scenarios," Reiko said, isolating her comm to his ship. She was annoyed that she couldn't direct her comments to the Admiral via implant. Captain Morney watched the blood rise along the Admiral's neck. As it was, Tripping chafed under Chechenko's command, believing he should have independent operational control over new Terran warships. But to be corrected by an Omnian Commodore during a fight might have been too much. Morney worried that the Admiral was about to commit a major blunder. But slowly, Tripping regained control and ordered Captain Philister to allow the bullet ship and sphere to pass unmolested. As soon as the Nual ship was out of danger, it collected its defensive vessel and sped off into the dark, with the Vivian's mirror hot on its vector. Tripping retired to his cabin and contacted Tatia.
"That was a farce, Admiral Tachenko," Tripping declared heatedly.
"Commodore Shimada's call was warranted, Admiral," Tatia replied. "At best, the Lem Ulam would have destroyed the bullet ship at the cost of its own survival."
"And then we would have had the sphere at our mercy," Tripping replied.
"That's conjecture on your part, Admiral, but Omnians are not in the habit of trading our ships one for one with the enemy. We value our humans and sages too much to see their lives spent in that manner. When we have an overwhelming opportunity to take the sphere and its bullet ship down, we'll attack, but not before then. Do I make myself clear?" Tatia worked to control her temper, but her patience with Tripping was wearing thin. When Tripping didn't reply, the metal rang in Tatia's voice as she said, "I require an answer, Admiral."
"You're understood, Admiral Tachenko. But let me add that I can't wait for the time to arrive when I'm freed from operating under the Omnian's foolish manner of conducting a fight with humankind's enemy. At this rate, we'll never defeat the sphere. And who knows how many more are out there?"
Tatia ended the comm and carefully stored the conversation with the hundreds of others she, her officers, and sages had collected. Alex, who had been privy to the conversation, studied Tatia's worried face. "What am I supposed to tell Reiko to do, Alex, if Tripping risks his ships and ours in the next confrontation with the sphere
by contradicting her orders.
What I think you're asking, Tadia, is whether you should give Reiko permission to withhold our forces from supporting the new Terran ships, if Tripping endangers his tridents contrary to her commands.
When you put it that way, it sounds rather cowardly, Tadia replied.
How do you think it will sound to Reiko and your captains?
Much the same way, Tadia admitted.
Tripping has his override box? Alex asked. He'd heard from Tadia of the Admiral's request that in times of crisis he should be allowed to divorce his tridents from the conflict. To accommodate him, Z was requested to design a program for the NT warships that allowed Admiral Tripping two functions. He could cut off the Liberator's controller interface with his ships, and he could shut down his ship's communication with the flagship.
"Yes, the Admiral has it," Tati replied.
"I imagine Z designed the interface so that the Saids can't interfere with it."
"Unfortunately, Z did exactly what he was asked to do. Create an impregnable procedure. Makes me think I shouldn't have been so specific," Tadia said, frustrated with her decision in hindsight.
"I think we'll have to wait and see what happens, Tadia. Right now I'm interested to see if we will get another shot at the sphere." Alex and Tadia exited the Admiral's cabin and returned to the bridge. Reports were inbound from the squadron and the scout ships as to the vector the sphere was on when it exited.
"What do you have, Julian?" Alex asked as he passed through the bridge accessway, noticing a small group had formed around the ship's holovid, studying the telemetry data.
Vivian's mirror was able to align itself directly behind the sphere for several moments before it exited this system's space, giving us a highly accurate fix on its vector.
"Any alignments with probes?" Alex asked.
"None," Julian replied.
The Saids had mapped the probes in the area when the warships had entered the system.
"None?" Reiko asked, disappointed that the one opportunity to capture or destroy the sphere might have slipped through their hands.
"Unfortunately not, Commodore," Julian replied. "But there is an opportunity."
"Give us good news, Julian," Tadia encouraged.
"The sphere's vector aligns well with a blue-white star."
"Which doesn't have a probe signal?" Svetlana asked.
"I'm with the Commodore on this. How is that possible? Every system we've investigated has had a probe. Why wouldn't this star have one?"
"Possibly due to the inevitabilities of space," Z replied. "It's logical that there would be accidents that would damage the probes, or there could have been a component failure that prevented this probe from communicating. In the latter case, it might be there but silent.
What's important to note is that this star doesn't produce a Nual signal for whatever reason," Julian said, looking at Alex.
The two of them relived the conversation the night they sat together at the rear of the bridge, discussing the Nual sphere's possible moves when its enemy caught up with it.
"We've surmised the Nual have determined they're being followed," Alex said quietly. "Which means there's a good chance we'll only get one more shot at them. They've jumped to a star without a probe. If we miss them there, it's highly likely they'll transit to open space and continue to move until they're sure they've lost us."
"It's inevitable the dastardly dear ones will communicate to other spheres about the big bad aliens who hunt them and how they're using the probe signals against their ships," Miranda offered.
"Which should lead them to augment their probe programs or change tactics entirely," Z surmised.
"They might have already communicated the message that Miranda has suggested," Svetlana said.
"Hopefully they haven't yet," Alex said. "But you can be sure that eventually they will."
"If you're correct, Alex," Reiko started to say, before she caught the expressions on the faces around her.
"Okay, let me rephrase that," she said, which garnered a few snickers.
"Using your hypothesis, Alex, it would be smart not to transit right behind the sphere. We'd find it in open space and lose it.
Perhaps we should wait and give the Nual time to relax, if they can do that, and investigate the system. That would at least give us a chance to trap it in a gravity field.
I agree, Commodore, Alex replied. Julian?
Julian briefly consulted with Z and Miranda. Afterwards he smiled and said, I'm suggesting 4 days, Z is arguing for 10, and Miranda believes that trying to understand the aliens' level of concern over whether they might be followed and what they might do next is a futile exercise.
Consensus not so easily reached, Renee quipped.
She'd been quiet while others struggled to determine a new strategy. We started destroying probes about 2/3 of a year ago, and we've been eliminating them behind us as we follow the sphere.
If Alex is right, she said, grinning at her tease, why did these technologically advanced aliens take so long to change their habit?
I can tell you in 2 words. The Confederation.
Interesting insight, Alex said, nodding his head in agreement.
Translation? Tatia asked.
We've surmised by the extent of probe distribution that we're dealing with an ancient civilization, Renee replied. I offer the Confederation as an example of a highly developed civilization that has enjoyed 7 millenniums of unimpeded growth. Of course, you'll note how elastic it is in adopting new ways.
Renee's comment generated murmurs and grumbles from the ex-independents and sages, who'd all suffered under the Confederation.
If the Nual are a much, much older race, they'll be holding on dearly to their methods, which have worked for them for who knows how long, Renee said.
We'll wait 4 days, Admiral, Alex said, accepting Renee's logic. Then we follow.
Admiral, a moment of your time, if you please, Rieko asked after the evening meal ended.
In 1 more day, the fleet would exit the system and transit to follow the sphere.
Admiral, you're being too careful with our forces. Either we want that sphere or we don't, Rieko said, once the door slid closed on Tatia's cabin.
I think we can dispense with the titles, Rieko. What are you proposing?
Following Alex's logic, we'll have only 1 more shot, if that, at the sphere. More important, if it hasn't broadcast what it might have discovered about our activities, I think it's crucial that we do whatever is necessary to destroy it, or at least prevent it from communicating.
I don't disagree with your reasoning, Rieko, but I'm still waiting for your proposal.
With our present strategy, Tatia, the sphere has too much room to slip past our squadron. If we want to prevent that, we have to commit the fighter squadron.
Our travelers are no match for the bullet ship, whether they encounter it 1-on-1 or even 4 or 5-to-1.
I don't disagree, Tatia. Our fighters will have to swamp the bullet ship, and we can expect losses. But if we eliminate the sphere's last defensive ship, it will be forced to flee.
And how does risking our people in a close fight with the bullet ship help us trap the sphere?
Did you notice the distance that was kept between the sphere and the bullet ship the last time we encountered it, compared to the vids from the Olasis system?
Tatia pulled the files from the ship's controller and ran a comparison for herself.
In the Worlds of Light, the sphere allowed the 2 ships to extend several times farther out than when it had a single defender in the last system, Tatia commented.
The Nual are getting nervous about their protection. They're keeping it close.
Agreed. Close enough for us to make use of that, Rieko replied.
Tatia thought through what Rieko was proposing and replied,
You're thinking that when our travelers eliminate the bullet ship, there will be a large arc of exit denied the sphere because of the fighter group's close proximity.
In a manner, look at this, Rieko replied. She activated the table's holovid and ran a simulation.
Julian helped me create this program using accurate figures.
Tatia watched the squadron close in on the sphere. Naturally, it chose the path of least resistance, with its bullet ship leading the way.
What am I missing, Rieko? This scenario doesn't work. No, it doesn't, Tatia, because it employs the same approach with the squadron that we were anticipating using. And it doesn't give us an opportunity to independently attack the bullet ship or the sphere. But what if we did this? Reiko asked, and sent a second simulation to the holovid. The squadron came at the sphere from above and below the ecliptic, dominating much of the escape opportunity. Left open were the paths across the ecliptic. Reiko froze the simulation, adding, "Where we discover the sphere within the system will depend on how we structure our attack. We'll need detailed advanced telemetry." "You want the scout ships to secure the telemetry and return to the squadron." "I want one scout ship to transit far outside the system, gather the data, and then return."
"That amount of delay runs the risk of delivering outdated telemetry to us, Reiko."
"It can't be helped, Tatia. We can't afford to scare the Nual away. And even if the sphere's position has shifted within the system, this scenario," Reiko said, pointing to the holovid display, "should easily adapt to the new sphere's position after the squadron arrives in system."
"What's the rest of the plan, Reiko?"
"Watch this final scenario, Tatia. In this one, we've scouted the system and determined the best vectors for attack and ambush." The latest display showed the squadron entering far outside the system's space. The entire fighter group exited the tridents, their velocity imparted by the warships. Then the tridents executed a double transit to position themselves above and below the ecliptic, trapping the sphere between them. Tatia froze the simulation and rotated the advantage point.
"Ah, clever girl," she said, when she noted that the fighters were grouped tightly together and heading directly toward a gas giant which screened them from the sphere.
"That's our ambush, Tatia. We drive the Nual toward a massive outer planet. The alien sphere will put the bullet ship out front, which our fighters can attack. In the meantime, our squadron will be accelerating to close the distance from behind. By the time the sphere decides to shift course, the tridents should have closing velocity. Then it will be up to Alex to decide whether to use our velocity to make a single attack pass with our beams, or to decelerate and see if the Nual will surrender."
Tatia laughed briefly and harshly.
"Just how are we supposed to determine if the Nual are surrendering?"
"I fight the warships, Tatia. I leave decisions like that to Alex."
"With that, I agree, Reiko. I like your strategy, but we'll have to talk this over with Alex."
"He won't like the plan, Tatia."
"That's true, Commodore," Tatia replied, returning to her commander's role. "But I'll be interested to see how you sell it to him."
Reiko eyed her admiral, who was her complete opposite in stature, broad and blonde to her tiny and brunette.
"You're too kind, Admiral."
"That's what everyone tells me," Tatia replied with a wink.
Chapter 23 Last Chance. Vivian's mirror transited to the blue-white star where the Nual ship had headed. The scout ship had orders from Tatia how to proceed, but Killian decided to amend them.
"And the reason for the new coordinates?" Trium sent to Killian and Bethley.
"Alex," Killian replied.
"And that truncated reply is supposed to explain the change?" Bethley asked, a little piqued.
"Alex wants a confrontation with this sphere. Only one scout ship was chosen to investigate to minimize our appearance outside the system, and we were chosen," Killian replied.
"A longer response, but no less clear," Bethley replied.
"You're asking us to think about why Dasida chose us," Trium reasoned.
"Or is it more a matter of our lead member unable to follow orders?" Bethley riposted.
"In a manner, yes," Killian replied. "Alex and I have had many conversations concerning the differences between humans and Sades. What I've learned to emulate about humans is the concept of initiative, and I have concluded that Alex expects me to exercise mine."
"'We've arrived below the ecliptic, and you've selected a steep inward angle,' Trium sent, analyzing the transit data and the new vector. "'This will bring us much closer in system than Admiral Tachenko allowed.' Bethley quickly extrapolated where the vector would take the Vivian's mirror and its possible appearance to the Nual. "'We will intersect that heavy outer planet, pass through its field of moons, and be accelerated by its gravity above the ecliptic. "'We should appear as simply another celestial body passing through the system,' Trium reasoned. "'Providing the Nual sphere doesn't take a close look at our shape.' In my calculations, Killian sent, I perceived less risk to being seen by the Nual if we appear as a rock coasting through the system, as opposed to standing stationary outside of it and waiting for our telemetry to update. In this way, we spend less time out here, come closer to the sphere, and collect more detailed telemetry. A bold idea, Trium replied. And a good one, Bethley allowed. If it works, she added. Many days later, and far above the ecliptic, the Vivian's mirror passed behind a small cluster of asteroids, which blocked the sphere's view of them. The Sage took advantage of the screening to transit to the fleet's position. "Alex, Admiral, we found the sphere," Killian sent. "Well done, the three of you," Alex sent in reply. "'Is it my imagination, or does Killian sound excited?' Tadia sent privately to Alex. "'They've been successful, Tadia. Why shouldn't Killian be happy?' Alex replied. "'The Alex effect,' Tadia thought, thinking of his influence on the Sades. Killian transmitted the scout ship's telemetry to the flagship, and the warship's controller relayed copies to all ships. Immediately, Julian spooled the telemetry onto the Liberator's holovid, utilizing time compression for viewing. "'That approach definitely wasn't following my instructions,' Tadia said, watching the scout ship enter space below the ecliptic and swing close to a giant planet before curving above the ecliptic. "'True, Admiral,' Alex replied, "'but it was extremely innovative.' The sphere was stationary during the entire time of the scout ship's passage, Julian noted. It's holding a position near the sixth planet outward, a cold, barren rock. I think you have all the information you need, Admiral. Set your strategy in motion, Alex requested. Tadia ordered the fleet to sail. They would be using Reiko's plan. Tadia busied herself with the Sades, determining the final details. Primary transit coordinates, fighter launches, and secondary transit coordinates. Tripping was ecstatic when he reviewed the attack positions. His warships were still above the ecliptic, but in this case that meant they wouldn't play ancillary roles. They would be part of the attacking force. He fingered the tiny control device in his pocket. This time the sphere doesn't escape, no matter what you say, Admiral. Tripping thought. The fleet transited to the first set of coordinates, which placed the ships far past the outermost planet's orbit. The tridents accelerated inward, and the captains ordered the launch of their fighters. The travelers were sent forward, sailing silently toward the massive outer planet at which they were aimed. As soon as the fighters cleared the bays, the squadron executed two quick transits. The first movements sent four tridents above the ecliptic and four below. The second transits placed the warships in positions to trap the sphere between them. Each group of warships was in a square formation. Two were positioned directly above or below the sphere, and the other two of each group were slightly inward. Their formations left the outward vectors across the ecliptic as the most favorable paths for the Nual. Franz brought his fighter group to a stationary position near the outermost planet. He was guided by Z, who would coordinate the fighter group's ambush with the sphere and the bullet ship's movement. Reiko focused intently on the holovid, which displayed the relative positions of the squadron, the sphere, and the waiting fighters.
Her plan was to manipulate the battle formation, and the Sage would emulate her actions via the ship's controllers. "Drop the inward tridents straight toward the ecliptic," Reiko ordered the Sage. She wanted the Nual to realize that she was denying them movement in more than a hemisphere of direction across the ecliptic.